Welcome to the February 2020 edition of the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation's Rehabcast. This is the official podcast of the Archives of PM&R, and I'm your host, Ford Vox. Now, in this particular issue, we are featuring a paper just from the February issue. Recently, we've been having two issues featured per podcast. Had a little bit of difficulty scheduling January's, and we may do that in a future edition of this podcast. Just so you know, the January issue of the Archives of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation features a series of papers on the development and results of the TBI Quality of Life Project. And this is important because these are health-related quality of life measures that can potentially be useful in a wide array of research in the TBI population. Look out for the series of papers in the January issue on that. As for the February issue, we're going to be talking with Dr. Abhishek Jawant. He is of the Weill Cornell Department of Rehabilitation Medicine. And we're going to be discussing the MoCA scale as it applies to inpatient rehabilitation of stroke patients. Without further ado, let's get right into that interview. So joining us now on the Rehabcast is Dr. Abhishek Jawant. He is an assistant professor of neuropsychology and assistant attending psychologist and a clinical neuropsychologist at the Weill Cornell College of Medicine in the departments of psychiatry and rehabilitation medicine. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Jawant.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
And you have published on in the February archives of PM&R on subgroups defined by the Montreal Cognitive Assessment and how they differ in functional gain during acute inpatient stroke rehabilitation. So tell us first about the Montreal Cognitive Assessment and its development and why you thought that that would be useful in inpatient stroke rehab.
Yeah, so the MoCA, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, or the MoCA, it's a cognitive screening instrument, 30-point screen where higher scores denote better performance, lower scores more impairment. It really came out more from the aging, mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's, dementia world. Mm-hmm. But it's become very commonly used in rehabilitation. And when I started here at Weill Cornell at New York Presbyterian, it was the standard measure that the occupational therapists were using on our rehab unit. And it was interesting because the cutoffs for these different subgroups of sort of normal, mild, moderate impairment that were being used were from what the original developers had published. Mm-hmm. But those really hadn't been validated in stroke specifically. And actually, even when you try to look for validation of those subgroups on the MoCA website, there weren't a lot of data, at least that I could find, to sort of define or think of, like, are those valid ways to think of different groupings of patients? And so knowing that this was something that was being administered on our rehabilitation unit at admission, a lot of my animating research questions were, is this a valid screen to be giving, and what does it tell us about the things that, patients and their caregivers and therapists and rehab professionals are interested in, which is function and functional gain. And from that, we did some earlier work on it. And from that, this paper really came to this idea of subgroups and, can we, are these groupings that we came to, do they provide clinically useful information? So that was the real research question that we were getting at here.
Mm-hmm. And I see you have a prior research interest in this area as well, of kind of, quick and dirty neurocognitive screens, maybe not so dirty, hopefully, but
right.
More efficient ways to clinically assess patients. And I see you previously published on a 30-minute neuroscience
right.
assessment battery in inpatient stroke rehab. Tell us a little bit about that prior work and how that informed this as well.
Yeah. So, again, it really comes from really clinically oriented and clinically driven research. So as I mentioned, the MoCA is the screen that all patients get on our unit. The occupational therapists are the ones giving the MoCA. But me as a neuropsychologist, I think You said it right. It's quick, and it's certainly dirtier relative to as in an outpatient setting when we have more of the luxury of time. This idea of, what tests are we going to administer, and how are we really going to get the most bang for buck in terms of what we're administering to patients and what those measures can tell us. And so the MoCA is something that's given on it. That our unit gives on admission, and that's something I was interested in. But from that, usually patients then get referred to nurse for a neuropsych evaluation by me. And then I was interested in, well, I've sort of through my clinical experience developed a battery or a set of measures that I thought were, from the literature and from my own experience, informative and useful. But could we empirically kind of validate the importance of those. And so that paper that you mentioned, it actually the measures were taken from a battery that was proposed by the National Institute of Neurologic Disorders and Stroke and the Canadian Stroke Network. It was a 30-minute battery that really loaded up more on executive functions, but tried to, again, it's a screen. And I found that I was using a lot of those measures anyway in my evaluations, and we had data collected on them. And so essentially, what we showed in that paper was interesting is that that 30-minute battery does have added value on top of the MoCA and also predicts, gain within rehabilitation and how patients are doing in terms of their IADLs at discharge. And so both the MoCA and these quick and dirty neuropsych screens we think can be helpful. So.
Okay. Well, listeners can look out for that paper. It's in the Journal of Neurological Sciences, and you published that back in 2018. The MoCA test, for those aren't familiar, takes about how long to administer?
10 to 15 minutes, I would say, with some variability depending on how sort of attentive a patient is or degree of language comprehension. I should say, in our paper that we really only we took participants and patients who were able to follow directions and attend and be alert enough to complete the evaluation. So it's fairly sensitive and it's fairly challenging. There's a miniature version of the trail making test for those who are familiar, and a quick recall test. And so it is sensitive, but it means it can be quite challenging for patients who that may be sort of above their level at that point. But 10 to 15 minutes usually is what our therapists find that it takes.
And of course, for anyone who doesn't recall, the perhaps most famous individual to be administered the MoCA is our President of the United States.
Yes.
That question came up a couple of years ago, and I think Ronny Jackson gave it to him famously,
Yes.
and surprisingly scored 30 out of 30. I'm a little bit suspicious about that still, but we'll
Me
see.
as well. And it kind of brings up an interest without getting too into the weeds on politics, this idea of sensitivity of sensitivity and specificity of these kind of screening instruments, and something that our previous paper, the Journal of Neurological Sciences paper, showed is that even in our sample of stroke rehabilitation patients, those who are scoring in our normal range in our 25 to 30 doesn't necessarily mean that they're totally cognitively intact. We did find a subset of them when we give them this additional 30-minute battery. There's more speed dependent tasks on it that it was picking up on subtle impairment. So I think that's,
I see.
brings up this point about cognitive screens and the limitations of them. And there really aren't substitutes for more, comprehensive cognitive evaluations. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Now, the original developers of the MoCA did set different subgroups that are being utilized on your stroke unit and that population, setting them a little bit more severe. I think you discussed in the paper that that was the idea that they really wanted something that I guess was more specific for clear-cut dementia. And what's your rationale for moving that up a little bit? Or obviously it was kind of done before your time perhaps, or but what do you think that makes sense?
It's a good question. So the approach we took to the subgroup, so it's sort of this broader question of how do you even start, where are your cutoffs, and how do you define them depending on the population and the question. In the literature, we had seen, and we refer to this in the paper, there's one previous paper that actually used the same score ranges that we did and looked at more underlying vascular disease. And then there was another paper that used a slightly different grouping scheme. The way we came up with ours was actually kind of an iterative process. So the rationale for using 24, 25, so 25 to 30 being normal and 24 to 20 being mild, was a previous paper we've published. This is even before the 30-minute neuropsych battery paper, where we showed that that cutoff point was the most. We did receiver operating characteristic curve analyses, where we can look at sensitivity and specificity, and that point seemed to be the most sensitive and specific to identifying cognitive impairment. And then the 1920, so 19 and lower being more moderate impairment, came from a paper published by one of my colleagues and collaborators, Dr. Joan Toglia, who showed that at that point, 19 and lower was most sensitive to having a functional cognitive deficit on an OT measure, a bill paying measure. So our rationale was, maybe this 20 to 24 range is where patients will have mild impairment, but they're not showing as much sort of functional or obvious functional cognitive deficits. And then this 19 and lower is where the more functional deficits are emerging. So that was where we came up, how we came up with those ranges. But you're right that it's not necessarily the best way to do it. And I think one of the limitations and really further directions is we have a huge range of scores. What we're calling moderate impairment is essentially 19 and lower, but there's probably more meaningful gradations in there that we didn't look at.
Well, it's a fairly a large study done out over several years. You got 334 stroke patients from 2012 to 2016, and ultimately you're trying to track these subgroups and how they ultimately have FIM recovery. And looks like you got quite significant results. Can you walk us through those?
Yes, exactly. So, what we found is that so our study is really limited to the inpatient rehab setting. We don't have long-term follow-up, but our main outcome measures were essentially looking at gain on the FIM as a measure of rehabilitation gain. So we had two primary outcome measures. One was the relative FIM gain, which is the amount of gain that the person, a person or a patient is making relative to the amount of points possible that they could gain on the FIM. And then the FIM efficiency, which takes that relative FIM gain and divides it by length of stay to look at, how efficiently on a day-by-day basis are these gains being made. And what we found was consistent with our hypotheses that essentially it broke down the way we predicted with the subgroup. So those who are scoring at admission on their MoCA in the normal range, so the 25 to 30, they make the most functional gain and they make it most efficiently. Those who are scoring in this moderately impaired range, 19 or lower, they're making least functional gains, they're doing it less efficiently. And then those who are in this mildly impaired range, the 20 to 24, they're somewhere in between. So not as much gain and not as efficient as the normal group, but better than that moderately impaired group. And this is accounting for age, sex, education, stroke severity, and whether or not it was a recurrent or a first-time stroke. We also found that these subgroups tracked with, if you look at the clinically meaningful change on the FIM, it's the normal group on the MoCA that has the highest percentage making a clinically meaningful change, those in the mildly impaired group who are a little bit lower, and then the moderately impaired group that are a little bit worse. And then one thing we did, this was more exploratory, was to compare how these MoCA subgroups did to the cognitive FIM, which was a more standard of care, kind of administered at it's rated by clinicians based on observations, so it's not performance-based, but how that did in predicting the same outcome. And we found that our MoCA subgroups did do a little bit better in terms of predicting rehab gain. And then we also argued that it's a little bit better and that particularly for patients who can handle the MoCA, given that it's who can do this 10 to 15 minutes, it's a useful measure to get a sense of predicting how much gain someone's going to make. It also gives useful qualitative information, particularly as a neuropsychologist. I like to look at the the patient's MoCA, kind of see how they did, and that informs my testing. But for those who, for some reason, can't participate in the MoCA itself, that the cognitive FIM, it does have utility as well. It seems to be predicting, just to a slightly lesser extent.
Yeah, and I think that matches a criticism of the cognitive FIM that's been out there for a long time, that it doesn't really show fine gradations very well.
Exactly.
It's a more crude instrument.
Yep, we see ceiling effects often, that people are just kind of scoring really highly and it's not really differentiating meaningfully between different patients. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so this study certainly emphasizes or reemphasizes for a lot of folks the relative a huge importance of the cognitive level of folks and how they're going to benefit over the course of inpatient rehab. And you mentioned that with similar lengths of stay as well, obviously that you're not seeing the same level of FIM change, an argument could be made that those who have more cognitive impairment coming in are going to need a longer length of stay in order to match up to the functional gain that they need.
Yeah, I agree. And I would just, and to that, I agree with you and would add to that, I think something my own research has taken me now from this work is to think of how do we, so in addition to longer lengths of stay, but for these patients who are in this mild or mild to moderately impaired range, do they need more, either more intensity or more cognitively focused interventions? We're developing on our unit, and we're sort of developing research protocols to look at things like computerized cognitive training. If we add, 30 minutes a day, would that be helpful for these patients who are showing cognitive impairment? Or if we do a more formalized metacognitive strategy training within occupational therapy, where we're really trying to increase awareness and build strategies, could that be helpful? So agree with you, longer lengths of stay. And also just, I think for me personally, and also kind of a call for people who are interested in this work to kind of, be thinking more about interventions and ways that we can support people with stroke patients with cognitive impairment.
Sure. You've mentioned a couple of times now how occupational therapy in particular has been involved in this tool. And I wanted to ask you about that. You typically think of perhaps the speech therapist.
Yeah.
More so, as I'm certainly are doing some cognitive therapy on your unit, but tell us a little bit about why occupational therapy in this case.
Yeah, it's a good question. In our unit, we have and speech therapy and the speech pathologists certainly also do their cognitive screen. So they do something called the CLQT, cognitive linguistic quick test. We have the MoCAs from occupational therapists, and then for those patients who come to me, I'll do this 30-minute battery that we were speaking about earlier in the conversation, or a different measure. But I think my sense is that occupational therapists, of course, they're not trained sort of in the same way as a neuropsychologist might be or a speech therapist might be, but they can sort of, they have this expertise in function. And I think over time, it's just become within their initial functional assessment, a way for them to get the screen of cognition and along with some of the other measures they're doing. So often on our unit, we use other functional cognitive measures within OT, things like the weekly calendar planning activity and this executive function performance test. They're more ecologically similar or valid kind of measures of bill paying or managing and organizing a schedule. And I think that's where the OTs really have their expertise. And but I think it sort of speaks to the interdisciplinary way that we're sort of thinking of cognition, and that it really has to be addressed across disciplines. Our physiatrists or residents actually do the brief mental stat, the BIMS, the brief mental status exam. So it's nice that each discipline kind of has their own screen, and we get to all put our heads together and put the data together and think of how to best to help the patient. So I think that's something so why the OTs do it kind of evolved over time and just become part of their initial screen that they do with the patients.
All right. Well, I think you already gave us a hint there of what you envision as perhaps your next project in this direction, or something it sounds like you're working on already, is adding a little bit more cognitive therapy, perhaps in the mode of some computer assisted and so forth to
Exactly.
these subgroups.
Yep, that's it.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing the results of that, and certainly we hope you choose the archives to publish in.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. And that'll do it for this February 2020 issue of the Archives of PM&R's Rehab Cast. Join us next month.
ACRM will be visiting Atlanta twice in 2020. First up will be the ACRM Training Institute at the Spring Meeting. Held April 23rd to 26th, this economical hands-on series of workshops and community meetings is ideal for networking and increasing your involvement in the world of rehabilitation research and clinical training. Then join us in the fall for ACRM 2020. Coming off a record-breaking year in Chicago, the annual conference is the number one meeting for interdisciplinary rehabilitation research and clinical practice. Go to acrm.org and click on Meetings to get started.